When Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of King Herod, behold, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is the newborn King of the Jews? We saw his star as it's rising, and have come to do him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was greatly troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Assembling all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea. For thus it has been written through the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, since from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod called the Magi secretly and ascertained from them the time of the star's appearance. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search diligently for the child. When you have found him, bring me word, that I too may go and do him homage." After their audience with the king, they set out, and behold, the star that they had seen at its rising preceded them until it came and stopped over the place where the child lay. They were overjoyed at seeing the star, and on entering the house, they saw the child with Mary and his mother. They prostrated themselves before him, and they opened their treasures and offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed for their country by another way. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
We've been, for the last couple of weeks, celebrating Christmas, the Christmas season, celebrating the incarnation, right? The fact that the great mystery that God has entered into his creation, that the infinitely far has come very near, that the invisible has made himself visible, that God has become one of us and in a sense made himself accessible to us, right? That he's taken on a human nature, he's taken on a body by which we can touch him, right? A face by which we can look at him, a name by which we may call him. And then today we celebrate the Feast of the Epiphany, which essentially builds on that incarnational principle and says not only that God becomes visible in Jesus Christ, but that he also manifests, which is another way of, it's another interpretation of Epiphany, manifests his glory, right? That he shows the people the fact that here in Jesus we find God fully revealing himself. And so in the person of Jesus Christ, we find our creator, the meaning of our lives, the fulfillment of our destiny, the cause of our happiness, whatever you want to say. Now, in the gospel, as I think you know, goes through a three-year cycle. And the three different gospels that we use to celebrate the Feast of the Epiphany, we have the baptism of Jesus in the Jordan, when the heavens open up and the voice of the Father says of Jesus, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." Right, we also, on one of the 3 years, we hear the gospel of the wedding feast at Cana, which is Jesus' first miracle, thus kind of manifesting, revealing his power and being a first glimpse of his glory. But the gospel that's maybe most intimately connected in our minds and hearts with the Feast of the Epiphany, probably because of its relationship to Christmas, is when we hear about the three magi, the three alternately interpreted as kings or wise men from the east who are guided by a star to come and adore the child Jesus. And there's a beautiful, there's something really beautiful about this imagery, because when we look at the Magi and what they represent, which is sort of the philosophers of antiquity, the great seekers of truth, many of whom tried to seek God in the stars, that they were led by the stars to the true God who reveals himself in the child Jesus. However, if we take this image and we hold it up against the other two images we have of the Epiphany, we realize that if we focus on the seekers or on their seeking, we're missing the point slightly. Right? Because the point of the Epiphany, this feast and this mystery, is the fact that God reaches out to us. He shows himself to us, and he gives us the ability to read the signs that he puts in our lives. I've spoken in the last couple months about something I've only picked up recently, about faith as a spiritual literacy, right? As the ability to read the signs that God gives us to communicate himself to us, that the signs are all around us. It's just a question of whether we can read it, whether we can understand what God is saying to us. And in a sense, the Feast of the Epiphany is, in a very significant way, a feast of faith, right? A feast celebrating the fact that not only does God reveal himself to us, but he makes us able to understand what's happening. Now, this has always been an important mystery for Christians. I would actually propose that in our modern times, this mystery is perhaps more important than ever. Let me tell you why. If we look to the wisdom of the ancient world, or even in the wisdom of the medieval world, there was a fundamental belief that reality was something we were born into, that reality was something we received, and that the way to be happy is to live according to reality. You'll forgive me, I'm an educator, so I've made myself intimately familiar with the history of education. So if you'll forgive me using this as an example. If you look at education in the pre-modern times, so maybe let's say before 1500, before the Enlightenment, that's not an accurate date, but you get the point. Before the Enlightenment, education was seen a particular way. And there's almost a pyramid of education, and at the bottom of that pyramid was the physical sciences, because it was basically just learning about how the world works. But as you climb up the pyramid of knowledge, you get to the metaphysics, to philosophy, and then in the Christian era, to theology. And the reason this was considered the top of the pyramid, the top of learning, is because this is where you studied the meaning of life. And this is where you studied being itself, the very nature of reality, not just the laws that govern the physical universe, but what being even is. And so it's considered to be the height of being an educated person that you studied the metaphysics, because education was meant to prepare you to enter into reality and to live according to reality. And the belief of the classical world and the medieval world was that you could only be at peace with yourself if you learned what humanity really is, so that you could live a really human life. Right? Just like they believe that you could only really be at peace with creation if you learned about the nature of creation and how the world works, so that you could enter into reality better and live more in harmony with reality. So then what changed? Why is this not the way things are now? Because if you look at the education system of today, the pyramid is basically reversed, right? Philosophy, theology, the metaphysical things, that's considered to be, at best, the bottom of the pyramid. It's down there with the humanities, right? Like literature, those things that are essentially useless, right? So if your child comes home from college and says, "Guess what, Dad? I want to be a philosophy major." It's very likely that the next thought that's going to pass through your head is, what on earth are you going to do with a philosophy degree? It's useless. And that's because we no longer think about the purpose of education being a better engagement with reality. But how is it that we've been able to throw that out? Well, we've been able to throw it out because we no longer think of reality as something that we have to engage. Right? The reason that we've placed technical skills at the top of the pyramid, right? Not what you know about reality, but what you can do, how you can reshape reality to fit your desires or to fit your will. It's because we've essentially decided that we don't need to be bound by nature. we don't receive a meaning of our existence, right? We essentially throw away revelation. And the way that this began was with an exaltation of reason, right? Man wanted to say, it's below my dignity to simply believe a bunch of things and live according to those beliefs, right? I should only believe in the things that I can grasp with my own intellect, that I can prove to myself and know to myself to be true, right? I don't want to receive from hierarchical authority their version of truth. I want to be able to use my reason to come to my own truth. And it's interesting if you watch the way this the Enlightenment unfolded. So in the beginning, it was they really believed that they could take all of the moral and cultural achievements of the ancient world and simply separate it from its religious foundations and its philosophical foundations. And because they believed so much in human reason, they really thought that they could keep the same cultural and moral values of antiquity, but simply base them on reason. And even to this day, if you meet a really thoroughgoing secular humanist, they get really offended about the notion that there is no morality divorced from God. Right? Because it's very important for their humanism to be able to say, I can reason my way to authentic morality. But the truth is, that's not what happened. Right? Once we divorced ourselves from revelation, right, which is to say, once we divorced ourselves from the fact that that the meaning of our lives reveals himself to us, once we have made ourselves the center of reality, we very quickly forgot what the meaning of our lives was. And then we essentially started this path of saying, I can determine the meaning of my own life, which is why the kind of the firstborn son of the Enlightenment was the Protestant Reformation, which split Christianity apart, which began the religious wars, where the Catholic faith was persecuted in a way that it hadn't been in Europe for 1,000 years, right? Not very long later, we have the French Revolution, all that goes on with that. I gotta hold myself back from a history lesson. But if this all sounds like hogwash to you, if it sounds like I'm making these things up or making an unreasonable academic application of reality, let me hold up to you an example that I think most of us still feel like is absurd, but that is a present reality today. And that's, I only use this as an example. The homily is not about this, but gender fluidity. We actually live in a world where we believe ourselves to be so divorced from any given reality that we don't feel like we should even be bound by the biological fact of whether we're a man or a woman. We've become that divorced from reality, right? That we will say, essentially, it's an inalienable human right that I should be able to determine for myself based on my experience or based on my inclination what gender I am. More than that, we go beyond just the traditional genders of male and female, and I think we're up to like 76 genders now of some sort. And basically the only thing that's able to determine which of these many, many genders you belong to is how you personally identify. So we see in this as the end of a 500-year course of divorcing ourselves from a given reality and buying into this notion that the only reality that matters is the one that I create according to my own desires. So, what's the point of all this? Right? Because Sunday Mass is not about the history of intellectual thought or education. But I think that the Epiphany and the mystery that we celebrate here today is the antidote to this problem that modern man is born into, this problem that we inherit, right? There is an instinct that the modern mind has that I think is right, but we've got to it from the wrong way, and so we draw the wrong conclusions. And that instinct is this, that it's beneath our dignity simply to live according to a set of rules. And that's something that we all intuit, right? That my life is not sufficiently explained, right, that I don't find meaning simply in following the thou shalt and the thou shalt nots. That's an intuition of modern man that I think is true, but they got to it the wrong way. Right, they got to that intuition by saying there is no reality that we have to conform to. Reality is something that's fundamentally shapeable by our will and our technical skill. Therefore, we can throw reality away. We would look at this and say, I would affirm that that's true. Right? Our life is not sufficiently explained or given meaning simply by following the rules, by doing the thou shalt and avoiding the thou shalt nots. But the conclusion that we must draw from that is it's imperative that we discover the meaning of our reality. And we can, because the meaning of our existence, right, the purpose of our lives is a person, we can only really build ourselves around that reality by meeting that person who's revealed to us as Jesus Christ. And this is where we come finally. It's against this background that I think emerges the necessity of prayer. And we must pray, brothers and sisters. And when I say this, please, please do not hear simply another moral imperative. Right? When I say we must pray, I don't just mean this to add this to the list of the obligations you have to fulfill to be a good Catholic. When I say you must pray, I mean it in the same way that I say you must breathe oxygen and you must eat food. If you're to live the faith in an authentic way, right, not merely accepting propositions, not merely living according to rules, then you have to have evidence in your own life of the fact that God is real, but even more than that, that Jesus Christ is God, that he is the meaning of our lives, that he is with us, that he is for us, that he's in dialogue with us. That's the only way that our faith can be something real and concrete that we can entrust ourselves to and live and have it sufficiently fulfill our dignity. So brothers and sisters, we have to have lives of prayer because we have to somehow be able to reach out and actually touch Jesus in our own lives in order for us to really find that Jesus is the meaning of our existence.